Hello and welcome to episode 10 of the V2 Academy. I'm Chris Lappin, and joining me as ever is Peter Prickett. How are you doing, Stephen, Peter?
Very good. Amazed that we've got to 10.
10? Yeah. So shortly we'll be joined by the former director of coaching with Arsenal and author, Gerard Jones. He's also had spells with Rochdale and Bradford and is currently working in the US. But first we thought we'd discuss coaching creativity. So, your creative players tend to be the problem solvers in small. So are small-sided games the best way to coach problem-solving skills?
Depends what you're asking them to do. I mean, what is problem-solving? Generally, you've got to ask a question.
Yeah.
So does that problem have to be solved in a small-sided game? Not necessarily. They've got more chance of getting the touches they need, but it could be that a particular problem they have to solve is more suited to a large-sided game.
Yeah.
Or a numbered game. The other thing is solving a problem necessarily creative? Now, I think a lot of the time when coaches set players a problem, they expect the players to give them a certain answer.
Yeah.
If they're expecting a specific answer and therefore a set outcome, just how creative are they being? So, I think there's an issue, or something of a paradox even, that if we're looking for creative players, for it to be truly creative, we have to have open-ended outcomes. If you ask someone to be creative, like if I put a blank piece of paper in front of you and say, go on, be creative, most of the time what happens is people will look at you with an equally blank look from that one that's on the piece of paper. And the same will happen if I throw someone a ball and I say, be creative. I don't know. They like a little bit of guidance.
Yeah.
But if I then say, I want you to do 10 keep-ups, there's nothing creative about that. It's a specific task. So, we want creative players, but there's a paradox there by saying, go and be creative. You're planning for creativity, so therefore, is it really creativity, or have you just push someone down a specific line? And if you have, that's not true creativity. We have to be brave and bold enough to almost throw away our session plan. To say, right, I want you to be creative against this player. Score a creative goal. Well, what does that mean? I want you to score a cross. Well, that's too specific. So we need questions. We need them to then set them up. For example, I asked the players a question tonight, and that was the session plan. The plan was a question.
Yeah.
The question was, what is a creative pass? And we got all sorts of answers, all sorts of ideas. And then it was followed up with, okay, can we try and do that within a game?
So I think not punishing your creative players when they're trying new things must be an important thing when coaching them to learn.
Yeah. I took a group last week and there was an under 10. And we were doing a little dribbling warm-up. Just, again, travelling in certain, in between one area and another area, and can you do a skill move as you travel?
Yeah.
And he would try a move, and worked, he just carried on. But if it didn't work, every time, he looked at me. Like he was expecting me to say something.
Yeah.
Eventually, I did say something, and what I said was, break that habit. If you're going to play for me this week, which he was, we were training for a match, don't worry. If you make a mistake, just get on with it. Or even if you think it's a mistake, just get on with it. Because I'm not going to call you up. If you keep making the same mistake, we might have a chat about it, but you're not going to get any punishment. Because sometimes creativity looks really, really stupid.
Yeah.
And we've all supported teams and watched players who frustrate the life out of us because they do something and you're thinking, oh my God, why have you done that? But then that player 5 minutes ago will do something new that will just amaze you.
Mm.
And that's because they got a creative and unusual way of seeing the picture and a different way of thinking. And if we want creative players, we've got to let them fail and also accept that the way they see the world and the way they see the game of football may not be the same as the way you do or I do. Because you know what? They might be that bit more creative than we are.
Yeah. So is it at younger age groups, is it difficult to get players to keep their head up when they're dribbling?
I hate the phrase, by the way. Head up. I've been saying this to players. I say, go on, head up. Just all look at the sky. Well, that's useless.
I mean more they tend to look at their feet when they're running. So
what I tell the players is what they really mean, but I don't think they found a correct way to articulate it.
Yeah.
Is stop staring at the ball.
Yeah.
It depends what they're doing. So I play a little game where if I've got my hand up in the air, you're doing a certain move. If I've got my hand down, you put your foot on the ball.
Yeah.
And I'll walk around. And it's just to get them so they're not just staring at the ball constantly and they start to scan with the ball at their feet. And I find that the more complex the move and the more alien the move is to them, the more they look at the ball.
Mm.
Which is perfectly understandable, because the greater the difficulty of technique, the more you're going to look at what you're doing. It's like, think about playing guitar and finding the chords.
Mm.
When you've not done the chord before, you look at your finger position. And when you've done it hundreds and thousands of times, you don't need to look anymore. So it's just, the more you practice, the less you need to look.
Yeah, it's like typing, isn't it? So I've been in admin for 18 years now, and I don't have to look at my fingers when I'm typing anymore. When I first started, I was
learning to drive. When the first time you change gear, you're probably looking at the gear stick.
Yeah.
Don't look at it after 10, 15 years.
So we're delighted to be joined on the line by Gerald Jones. How you doing this evening, Gerald?
You alright, Chris?
Yeah, very well. How have you been since we last spoke? It's about a year ago, I think.
Good. Just busy. It's normal. Just crazy.
Yeah, I think last time we spoke, you were about to have an interview with Bradford, I think, maybe.
Yeah, I did a short stint there with my kid. He was through Ryerson International Club. So I did a short stint. I was assistant on the 21s.
Yeah.
With Bradford, which involved, obviously, the American players coming working with the youth team and the first team, which was good. So I was there for about 8 months. I resigned in February this year, and I'm now obviously stateside.
So for those who didn't hear the first interview, do you want to quickly go over your journey into coaching again?
Well, obviously I've been coaching since I was 15. I used to be a player with Halifax Town when they were in the conference. I was a youth team player. I started working with the Centre of Excellence. Went on, obviously, coaching in college and Caldwell College, worked at primary school level. Set up my own business. I was a university head coach at Huddersfield Uni. Then obviously ran my own business. Went on to coach at academy level. I've worked all over the world. UK, US, Italy, Norway, New Zealand. Been coaching for over 10 years. A-licensed coach. And I'm currently a director coaching at Eastside FC, which is a club in Michigan.
Yeah.
Most point. So I'm working with directors, academy players, which is similar to a Cat 3 academy back in England within the EPPP. Obviously, they have different divisions. I've worked as an academy coach at Rochdale AFC, which is a Cat 3 club. I've been a director coaching at Arsenal Soccer Schools, one of the largest soccer school programs in the world. And obviously, I was working at Bradford City for a short while with their 21s as an assistant. That's me in a summary.
You always also published a book, Let's Talk Soccer, Using Game Calls to Develop Communication and Decision Making Within Football. So you can tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, my first book was around communication, something that I developed from a master's degree. I've always worked on game calls.
Yeah.
I always try, and it's I wasn't necessarily something that was Gerard Jones. I'm sure similar to obviously you guys, different level, you always pick up little things from people. And I'm lucky that I worked with John Cartwright, used to be at Arsenal, West Ham legend. I'm lucky that obviously these guys are with Terry Venables, Don Howe, Ron Greenwood. One of my mentors, John Cartwright, and obviously Roger Wilkinson, were big on communication and how they get the best out of the players in terms of the specific vocabulary they use. And I was interested in that. I did my master's degree study on it, working with the players at Rochdale. And then obviously I've just evolved it into a book.
Yeah.
In terms of specific game calls that the players use in order to keep the ball or get the ball back or work on the positioning, where they're going to position themselves on the field.
So who is the book focused towards? Is it towards an amateur coach or a professional coach?
All coaches, really. There was a lot of terminology when I first wrote it that was the author, I'm the author, the publisher felt was too complex that maybe some people won't understand. I don't know if I fully agree. But it's been not dumbed down a bit, but you know, it's a lot simplified so that any coach, whether it be a parent, volunteer who's new to football, could pick it up and could easily understand it, relay that to his grassroots players, or somebody who's in the academy game who could use it as a framework and evolve it.
You talked about it's game calls. So what would be an example of a game call?
Well, it varies. I mean, the biggest thing, what we do at our club, we've got a specific coaching vocabulary. An example would be for the boys who want to recognise how to start again. So they can't play forward, they're in a danger. You're in a danger now, Peter. Then it might be, okay, I would shout start again, which would tell you to play the ball back. The right back might be away from the ball, and he might shout play round, which tells the boys to play around that opposition. It might be press. So sometimes our boys will be getting ready in position, and they may tell, Peter, press, no turn. And it's very clear information. There are examples of game calls that we use, and it's specific to our vocabulary. You know, holding space. There's players we've got now in our club who are directors, academy players. They'll try and get in an opportunity where it's a third line pass, where they're holding space. And that'll be a game call, Peter. You know, Tom Sheffield will go, holding space, and it tells the boys that he's in a position. And it can work two ways, because once the opposition realise what you're doing, then obviously it can also work as a disguise as well.
So does the book therefore also work as an explanation of jargon to some extent? So language that main for a young player who's starting the game, the classic example that's often given is the probably apocryphal story that they give on coaching courses where a coach tells an under-9 player, sit in front of your defence, so the boy goes and sits down. Because they've never had the jargon or language explained to them.
I think it's important the words that you use, and you've used one there, jargon. That's the whole reason for it. We've got a very clear, and it's something that I've used for over 10 years, that has developed a track record of players going on and doing well. And at U7, we're not going to say to them, space, you know, what, up there? So I know exactly what you're saying. We'll talk about where can you stand, where might you go. We'll simplify the words for them. Sitting down in the pass, pressing at hip level. The big word we use at the earliest age is surfing. So from U7 right through to U19s, and the boys do understand it, and so do the girls, we get them into a surfing position. So they're pressing at hip level, surfing, their arms extended, and they understand that, and that's an internal game call. So I don't believe in jargon. I think that's a fancy way of coaches confusing the kids. We work on one or two words that are action, and they instantly paint a picture in the mind of the player. And it's important to show the player when that could be used or what it relates to. So we show the players what surfing uses. To give you an example, one of our coaches at the weekend, we're currently on the second block of our curriculum. So rather than bamboozling the players with loads of information, Chris Ancona said one word. Addy, great surfing. Well done. How might you surf? Where might you go now? Brilliant, well done. And that was one word he used throughout. And it was very clear that the girls were getting into them positions. They're pressing at hip level, they're pushing off the toes. And just to give you an example, that was U9s, U10s. And it wasn't confusing for the players. And I'm a big believer in having that clear thread so that we're all using the same terms. Because
I have just come in from the development centre session this evening, yeah.
Got it. I mean, so you'll know, from going from coach to coach, you might coach a player, and obviously I'm from the north of England. I don't know where you're from, but you're from a different geography. Then all of a sudden, I might describe a particular action using a different verbalisation. It can confuse players. For me, it's important that we're on a very similar wording so that the messages are always consistent. So it's not jargon, it's clarity.
So it's dependent on everyone knowing what that word means or equals. I mean, we had a little while ago, I was working on pressings, probably two seasons ago, and the boys between them decided that the trigger word, because they found it funny, was pretzel. So when one of them shouted out pretzel, they went and pressed, and that's something they came up with, and they all knew what it meant, even though to somebody else, it's nonsense.
Right, okay. That's interesting, that one, what you said there. I think it's important to get their ownership, which is what you've achieved. I don't know if I'd want my players to say pretzel, because I'm trying to prepare them for... depends what you're preparing for. I think if you're a grassroots coach and you want them to have fun and they've had a bit of autonomy in the wording, and like you said, they all understand it, I think that's okay maybe to some degree. But I'm not working with an 8-year-old or a 10-year-old or a whatever-year-old. I'm working with a 25-year-old in the early part of their career. So when he's 25, is he going to play Division 1 college? Is he going to be like Christian McCowan, who I coached, who's played in the PDL this summer? Is he going to be like James Query, who played for Xavier University, Division 1 college? Is he going to be like Tom Sheffield now? I know these names won't mean anything to you, but I'm trying to give you examples. We're a grassroots club. Tom Sheffield's a U13 boy, and he's currently been identified by ODP, which is part of the Olympic Development Programme, developing future US national team players. So for me, I wouldn't necessarily, I'd let them have a buy-in, and I think what you've done there is really powerful, letting them, you know, sometimes have a say in what word they use. So in our club, some of the boys didn't like start again. So what the coach said is, what would you like? And they said, recycle. Now to me, someone says recycle to me, I think, what, the bins? But the kids understood what recycle meant, so that's a game call that they use. I think if that's why we're trying to be more performance-based and try and prepare them for that element of the game. That's the way we work.
What do you think prevents good communication from happening on the football pitch?
The coach not showing up on the sideline and talking too much.
Really
simple.
Is that the biggest factor?
I think it's one of the main fundamentals. I'm not saying go to the other extreme where you don't say anything, even though there is a place for that, as you know. There's a place for that. But for me, as soon as the coach is doing all the verbalisation on the side, you know, tuck in here, go here, Peter, right shoulder, be aware, Peter, come here, da-da-da-da-da. And he's micromanaging the session or the game. When the players don't know what to do, as you will know from your experience, they'll look over to the bench every time. And then they'll say, why aren't you talking on the field? Why aren't you communicating? But what they don't do is they don't give them the autonomy to do it themselves. Whereas what we try and do is we'll do a constraint. So, for example, we will say, you know, if you can regain the ball in your half, we were doing a small-sided games week a week ago. We split the game into an half. If you regain the ball and intercept and count, you score two goals. But if you do it by surfing and telling each other when to press, when to drop and how to press and using the game call, we'll give you two goals or whatever it may be. And then on the Saturday, we're saying, right, we're going to look for how many times can you surf? he shows what surfing looks like, or, you know, Brady Odell, Brady, can you communicate to your back players? This was yesterday, the U12 game, they're playing away, and Brady's communicating to his players. Tom, who's the coach, Peter, never said a word. And everyone's going, wow, how come your team are communicating, they're all more organised? It's purely because the coach has given the players the ownership. I think when the coaches say one thing but do another, why would the player speak? Because, you know, the coach is going to do the talking anyway. So we try and give them that empowerment and sit back and see if they do it themselves. And then obviously reward them for doing it.
We had a moment a couple of weeks ago. We're defending a corner and there was 2 minutes left and the team was 2-0 up. And one of the centre-backs wanted to go forward. And his teammate said to him, no, you sit here. There's X amount of time to go. We don't need another goal. Stay here. I'll cover this guy. You stay in front. And it wasn't just that he communicated. It was that he communicated the correct information. What happens when the information that's communicated is incorrect? What do you then do?
Well, it's like anything, isn't it? As you will know, when you're coaching, it depends how many times they do it, when they do it. Is it relevant now? Depends if I'm going to coach everything in one game or one session. Sometimes I'll ignore and I'll park that for another day. If he says start again, I'll give you an example. The boy shouts start again, but we're on the edge of the box and we're about to score. Obviously, he doesn't need to start again. He's going to put a shot in or he's going to cross the ball in. That's clearly not the right time to maybe start again. I'd probably revisit that at the end of the game or ask him a question, you know. Did he need to shout start again? What's the danger? What was he about to do? Why are you in the field? Was the ball? And the normal interventions you would do. But I think the key is getting them to talk and getting them to, you know, wreck it and not be embarrassed. I do it with the coaches all the time. We do CPD. I manage 5 full-time coaches here. And I get them to put on sessions and get them to say things and manage us. And I think it's that ability to not be embarrassed of saying something to your peers. And like your boy there who's done that, that's awesome. And if it was the wrong information, you know, who cares? He's tried. And then you can talk about, well, was that the right time? Should he have done this? What might you have done differently? And that's all we try and do. The big word I say all the time, parents get crazy because, you know, Danielle, I coach one of the girls' teams as well as the boys' team, and she gets the ball, and now she's dribbling out from the back. And I always say to her, what's the solution? Whereas the parents are like, get rid of it, or whatever is the default. And that's the big word for me, solution, let them figure it out. And that's how I deal with it.
Do you think that some players just simply don't have it in their makeup to communicate? When I was playing, I wasn't a great communicator, and I was too busy worrying about my own game, if I'm completely honest looking back. Do you think that some players are like that, or does every player have it in them? It just needs to be coaxed out.
I think the latter, what you said, the latter. And I think as well, when we talk about getting them to communicate, it doesn't necessarily mean organising each other. It can also mean organising yourself. So I would talk about like internal verbalisation, or I would, like, for example, I set the players' homework. There's one boy who's really shy, and if you get 2 words out of him, it's a miracle anyway, never mind game calls. And I just said to him, can you watch a game and tell me how many times they drive and slide, drive and shoot? And he watched the game with his dad, Premier League game. He's like, God, there's a drive and slide, there's a drive and shoot, there's a this, there's a that. And I said to him, can you try that on the weekend? Or can it be like, can you shout start again? I think getting the player, it doesn't have to be where, like your example was, where the boy's organising another boy. So he's worrying about the team. I think if you're getting the players to demand the ball, and it's an interpreter, start again, or demanding the ball, I think that's different because you get that confidence out of them. You sort of build it out of them. That's what I've found anyway. It doesn't always work. But there's one boy in our U14s who's really, really quiet. And we've started to get him now shouting in space, start again. And we've just been putting him on demands in terms of, you know, you cannot get the ball in this practice unless you use a game control. So we've restricted it, but then it gets it out of him. I mean, it depends how you do it. There's different ways of manipulating what you want in them.
Do you think age and experience have an effect on how good a communicator a player can be?
I think so, but I hope I'm not going off track. I think it's really hard. We've tried to, and I've done it for years now, try and get the kids to verbalise what they see in the situation. And I think if the sort of 15, 16 upwards, it's very difficult because they're almost maybe sometimes embarrassed or whatever of using these words. I think if you get them in young, a U7 onwards, where they're all enthusiastic and things like that, it's not so bad because they're not scared of, they'll say things and you can encourage it more. From my experience working with college players who are like 18, 19, 21, getting them to shout play around and things like that doesn't work, not all the time anyway. So I think sometimes is that maturity level, or do they understand the relevance? Do they know why they're doing it? Or, you know, do they feel comfortable? I think it just depends how you package it, but they're sort of things that I've noticed.
Because I think what I've noticed is often as they get older, well, not even as they get older, sometimes it's just depending on the type of person they are, personality they are, who their peers are, they just won't ask the questions as well. And usually if they won't ask a question, then they won't communicate later. And saying, do you understand, something I avoid, normally you just get nods from everyone, even if they don't understand.
Yeah.
I make it clear as often as I can, please ask questions. I like questions. Questions show that you're involved and encouraging them. But if the questions aren't encouraged, that's communication being cut off immediately.
I agree. First thing I did when I was a first team manager, my league level with adults, I said to them, and I say the state in this organisation here, because what you always get is sometimes negatives, especially with older players. Why is it? Why won't we? And I encourage an environment where, you know, you have to ask questions. You have to ask questions of each other. And I think the big thing, and this is probably why Leicester City did really well last year, if you look at a lot of the successful sporting organisations in the world, they all have communication at the heart of what they do. You look at the All Blacks, if you have an opinion piece, then you have to share it. And that's the culture I try and develop with the young players as well as the adults is, you know, you've got to share it. But if you've got a problem, you've also got to be first to bring the solution. And that's powerful. That's how I've noticed we develop communication. I don't think we do enough. I hope I'm not boring and going off fast, but I don't think we do enough on the courses on training psychology. I don't know, you know, when you do your badges, I don't remember when I did the UEFA A or UEFA B or FA Level 2, anybody sitting down with me and talking to me about how we can get our players working more as a team, how we can develop a psychological corner, even coaching a session just purely on the psych, social corner. I only got that when I did the Advanced Youth Award, and that was the first time in 10 years, and I was like, wow.
Well, the last few things I've done, we have been encouraged or been told that actually we need to look at the psych corner far more. But that's been, and yes, the Youth Award, that came through, but on the last course I did, which is Futsal UEFA B, was we need to look at this psych corner, because that's where things are going wrong most often.
Yeah.
Because most of the time they got the other ones, because we've, the last decade probably, we've heavily looked at the technical and the physical.
Yeah.
And we've ignored that psychological one. And I think most people are confused by the social one as well.
I can't agree more with you.
It's that psych one where you just got to look at people like Balotelli. Technically, physically, got the lot. Psych corner, got nothing.
I agree with you. I think as well, like dealing with, we've got a boy now in one of our teams, U14s, and emotional control in terms of dealing when things go against him, or the referee, or, I couldn't agree more with you. I really couldn't agree more with you. We always focus on that other side of the model. We never focus on what is it, what the right side. I agree.
Before you finish, do you want to plug your social media and any websites?
Yeah, I mean, my website, I'm uploading a lot of videos now actually of stuff that we're doing in terms of skills curriculum, some sessions. It will give people ideas in terms of practice design. I'm going to upload some PowerPoints. GerardSchoolOfFootball.com.
Yeah.
www.GerardSchoolOfFootball.com. Follow me on Twitter, it's @Gerard_Jones. And I'm happy to talk to anybody, you know, comments, session plans, bounce ideas back and forth, happy to all.
Yeah, and where can people find Let's Talk Soccer?
Let's Talk Soccer is available via Benny & Kearney, which is the publisher.
Yeah.
You can also get it if you look online, Google, you can get it via my website. Also, it's on Amazon.
Amazon, too. So $9.99 on Amazon.
UK or Yeah, or the US version, you can get on Amazon.
That's it. I really enjoyed speaking to you today. Sure, Peter has as well. And I'd love to have you on again in the future.
Thanks, Joe. Really good.
Honestly, I really appreciate it, Peter. If it, and it'd be good to try and talk about even other topics. Let me know. It'd be fantastic.
Yeah, so we're going to do... If this is the last of this series. We're going to do a new series and just after Christmas. So if you, I'd love to have you on again.
Yeah, even talk about other areas. Absolutely. Yeah. It'd be great.
Okay. Well, I'll stop recording there. Okay.
What's your thoughts anyway? How are you finding your season now that